Today is Wednesday, May 2nd, the year 2001. We're in East Lansing, Michigan, on the campus of Michigan State University. I am Jeff Charnley, interviewing Dr. Lawrence von Tersch for the MSU Oral History Project for the sesquicentennial. The university will be commemorating that anniversary of 150 years in the year 2005. As you can see, we're tape recording this oral history today. Professor von Tersch, do you give us permission to record this interview?
Correct.
Okay. I'd like to start first with some questions about your educational background, personal background. Where were you born and raised, and where did you go to school before college?
I was born in Waverly, Iowa in 1923. I graduated from Iowa State in 1943 with a bachelor's degree in electrical engineering.
Mm-hmm. What interested you in that field as an undergrad?
I didn't really start to school as an electrical engineer. I started to school as a mathematics major because I liked mathematics. Times weren't too good in those days for mathematics majors, and I decided to switch to electrical engineering because I could take all the mathematics I wanted to take anyway, and I might be able to get a job.
The war was obviously, World War II was going on then. After you graduate, that intrude on your on things at the time?
I graduated in 1943 and was direct commissioned in the Navy.
Okay.
As an ensign in the Navy.
And where did you serve during the war?
Well, I went to school at MIT for a while, learning how to maintain radio and radar equipment. Then I maintained equipment on Pearl Harbor, Johnson Island, Kwajalein, Guam. I was on Okinawa when the war ended. Mm-hmm. I was going to go to Japan to maintain equipment as soon as the Marines had an airfield tamed, which I didn't have my heart in.
Mm-hmm.
And when the war ended in the way it did, I went to China.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed in China until fall 1946 and went back to graduate school.
Mm-hmm. Where were you in China?
Shanghai, mostly.
Shanghai? Uh-huh. What were did you see any combat, direct combat, or were you behind the lines?
No, I didn't. No, I was too close sometimes, but no. Mm-hmm. The answer is no.
Mm-hmm. Did your World War II service stimulate your interest in continuing on in graduate study, or?
I would have gone to graduate school anyway.
Uh-huh.
It delayed it a little bit, and with the GI Bill made it easier, uh-huh. But I would have gone to school anyway.
I see.
Mm-hmm. I think.
Uh-huh. So you went back to Iowa State?
I went back to Iowa State. It uh-huh. had changed a great deal in the 3 years I was gone, so I went back.
Mm-hmm. And then you worked on what, on your master's and PhD?
Yes.
Okay. And when did you get your PhD complete?
1953.
Mm-hmm. And your dissertation or your primary research?
Well, I did study. I have to give you an explanation probably. There were very close ties between the physics department and electrical engineering at that time. And I did my dissertation work really in physics, and I had a choice of declaring whether I wanted a PhD in physics or electrical engineering, and I chose electrical engineering. I'm not sure I chose right. I've wondered about it ever since, but that's beside the point. But I chose electrical engineering. But my thesis operation and my research had to do with the injection of electrons into a synchrotron, which is clearly physics.
Mm-hmm. Were you interested in working in the private sector or teaching after you finished the PhD?
Well, I decided, I did a lot of teaching while I was as a graduate student, and I decided that's what I wanted to do. I was very happy doing that, and I think I was reasonably good at it, and I decided I wanted to do that.
How did you first get involved with computers, and was that in the Navy, or?
No, there weren't any computers in the Navy at that time. Much of the work that we were doing with the synchrotron and the accelerators at that time required a great deal of computer work. And I did a great deal of computer work down at the University of Illinois. I never had any formal attachment with Illinois, mm-hmm. but I did a great deal of work down there. And that led me on into the computer business a little bit.
How would you describe that, the computers, the ones that existed in the early 1950s?
Well, we thought they were pretty remarkable. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't think so today, of course. But they did their job. They created a new class of people who went on to do great things in the.
Mm-hmm. Any people that you had in those early years that later went on to be prominent in the field that you're aware of?
I don't know if they went on to be prominent in the field, but they've all done very well. I had, interestingly enough, as an instructor as an undergraduate, a man named John Antonazoff. I don't know if that means anything to you or not. John Antonazoff, by the courts, was deemed the legal inventor of digital computers, as we know it. He never made a dime off of it.
Oh, is that
but the
right?
courts decreed him as the legal inventor.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time, I didn't know he knew anything about computers anyway.
How was it that you ultimately came to Michigan State?
John Ryder, who was dean at Michigan State of Engineering at Michigan State, I'd had for a great number of classes at Iowa State, and I had a great deal of respect for him.
And he was here?
He was here as dean.
Uh-huh. And he came from Iowa State?
No, he didn't. Uh-huh. He came here. He had left Iowa State some years before, and he was department chairman of electrical engineering at the University of Illinois.
Oh, I see.
I'm not sure when I think he came here about 1954 from mm-hmm. University of Illinois.
I see. So he was the main one that recruited you?
Yes.
Uh-huh. What was the campus like, or how was it different when you first arrived?
Oh, there's probably more similarity between the campus. Have you ever been on the campus at Iowa State?
No, I haven't.
There's more similarity between the campus at Iowa State and Michigan State than probably any other two institutions.
Is that right?
They're very similar.
Mm-hmm.
They're very well landscaped. They're
land-grant schools.
Both land-grant mm-hmm. schools mm-hmm. started about the same, somewhere within 2 or 3 years of each other, and have a great deal of mm-hmm. similarity.
Mm-hmm. And so there was a strong engineering connection between
yes,
the two.
But their campuses were very similar at that uh-huh. time, and they still are.
Mm-hmm. How would you describe the academic climate here when you first arrived? Those are the John Hanna years, of course.
Well, I wasn't impressed with academic content in electrical engineering, but it improved.
Were there very many students in that field at that time?
I don't remember how many. Oh, there are quite a few. I don't remember what the enrollment of the College of Engineering was at that time.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. I don't remember.
When you first arrived, was there any main emphasis or strengths, or did those come later?
No, I think they came later pretty well.
Uh-huh.
Ryder wanted to change. It was strictly an undergraduate school at that time, and it had some strength in undergraduate. Ryder wanted to improve the strengths in all areas in undergraduate and create a research program. He was a little rough on how he did it, but he did it.
How were you involved with the computer lab when you first came?
How was I involved? I'm the founder and the first director.
Okay.
Is that what?
That's true. Tell me a little bit more about that. You had to create it, and
there wasn't a computer laboratory when I came here.
Okay.
I was hired by John Hanna to create one.
Okay.
And we did.
Were there, who funded it? Was it?
Well, The university funded made the original funds on the thing. It wasn't very much by current standards, but it was enough to get us started. We made a copy to start with of the Institute for Advanced Study machine, which was at Illinois and at Princeton. And we got an awful lot for not much money. Particularly, we got very, very significant software packages from them that we couldn't afford to create on our own. I think it was a pretty crude machine. It had it took us about 10 months to build it right over here next door
in the computer center.
What?
In the computer center, or what is now the computer center?
Which was, yeah. Mm-hmm. Breslin labeled it the computer center. That came later.
Mm-hmm. So 10 months to what were some of the major problems you encountered in
putting it together? Took us time to do all that. Mm-hmm. There were no major problems particularly. We were concerned at the time about whether we would be able to, as I say, we got a great deal of software packages from the University of Illinois and some from Princeton, but we were worried whether we could create enough programming knowledge on the campus to utilize it effectively.
Mm-hmm. Who on campus was the driving force behind, in addition to yourself, who saw the need for it?
A man by the name of Gerard Weig, W-E-E-G, who was a mathematician from Iowa State, who had worked for Remington Rand. He knew a great deal about software that we needed very badly. Mm-hmm. He's not living.
Mm-hmm. And he was here also?
Hmm?
He was on campus also?
Yes, he came here at the same time I did.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't know him when.
Oh. Go ahead with your thought.
We knew we had to start teaching some programming courses to get that, and we had a little trouble figuring out who was going to teach them. We taught them originally in the Department of Mathematics, but they weren't much interested. I had the feeling they thought we were kind of a passing fad and then maybe we'd go away, which we didn't.
Then the other programming, did you develop the computer science department?
Oh, that
ultimately?
Came very, very much later. I think.
Uh-huh.
We finally took the programming courses and some other relevant courses out of mathematics and put them in electrical engineering.
Okay.
And then eventually that was known to be a temporary thing until we got. And then eventually we got courses out of electrical engineering into what we then call a computer science program that turned into the computer science department.
Mm-hmm. Where would you say MSU was in relation to other universities in that development?
Well, we were lagging behind in the development of software, numerical analysis, and what have you at the time, but we were gaining very rapidly in the thing.
Mm-hmm.
I was quite amazed at, from time to time, at the activity that took place with a little encouragement on a variety of places in the campus.
Mm-hmm.
Really came around. Yeah.
What was some of that?
Agriculture, for example.
Ag research?
The Ag Experiment Station funded a lot of software operations necessary for agriculture. I was surprised to see that some of the writing programs, which you probably know more about than I do, started to come into existence. And of course, we didn't have lots of programs out of engineering, of course. And we had some limited programs originally out of business. But as I say, overall, I can't remember the details, but I remember being impressed that a lot of areas on campus were picking up business pretty well.
Mm-hmm. What about the cyclotron? Is that developed?
Oh, the cyclotron is a big customer, big user. Henry Blosser was, mm-hmm. Yes, very much so.
Mm-hmm. It's like chicken and egg with the existence of the computer and the computing capability stimulated the cyclotron.
Yeah.
And
yeah, Henry was a big backer of it, big user. Mm-hmm. Very sophisticated one.
Mm-hmm. How would you say President Hanna's support was? for
Well, he gave us some interesting support for the next step. The machine we built didn't last very long. When I say that, it didn't fall apart or anything like that, but mm-hmm. we created more business and more need than it can handle. So we asked Hannah for $1 million to buy a commercial machine, which didn't shock him a bit. And he had an interesting answer that I recall very, very well, and that is, he didn't know if it was the right place to spend $1 million on or not. But if I could get half of it from someplace else to prove that it was a good move, he'd see what he could do, which meant he'd do it. And I got it, and he did.
Where'd you get the money?
What?
Where'd you get the money?
National Science Foundation. Mm-hmm. I got $500,000 offhand from mm-hmm. National Science Foundation, and Hannah produced the rest, as he said he would. Mm-hmm. And we bought a machine from Control Data Corporation called the 3600, mm-hmm. which was a big step up for us.
And in retrospect, was that a good choice, you think?
Beg pardon?
In retrospect, was that a good choice?
Yeah, it was.
For the time?
It was. Mm-hmm. It was, as I look back on it, it was probably a fine choice. As far as
Had you had much experience with grant writing prior to that?
No, that not much.
That was your...
Well, that's not entirely true. One. I'd written a number of not for that order of magnitude, but I'd written a number of small ones at Iowa State, and I had not written any for... That was a lot of money at the time. For
yeah. Oh, but do you remember what year that was?
No.
I know.
Must have been...
not meant to be a quiz, but...
Must have been close to 1960, I'm not sure.
1960, yeah. Did you have contacts at NSF, or that knew your work, or knew the work at Michigan State, or would that help, maybe?
The director of our Division of Engineering Research, a man named John Hoffman, had good contacts at NSF. Mm-hmm. He knew where to go and who to ask.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Dr. Blosser talked about that when developing the site.
Blosser's always had superb context there. So. Mm-hmm.
The in those early years, would you say that what was the impact of that computing on the campus?
Well, it's hard to, as I say, I was impressed even with our limited capability to start with, what it had engendered all the way around. And the new machine, which we bought, carried on that quite a bit and expanded everything. Mm-hmm. We had a booming operation going in the center.
When did they get involved in using the computers for academic records and that sort of thing?
There had always been a data processing unit on campus that didn't have any academic interactions on the thing. Mm-hmm. It was a punch cards installation and a very effective one, and it had always been done there. Mm-hmm. And it's still there. Mm-hmm.
How did you first get involved with administration at Michigan State?
Well, I suppose there was some administration. You would consider some administration as director of the computer laboratory. I mean, I think so. Two years after I came here, let's see, in the spring of 58, the chairman of electrical engineering resigned, and I was appointed chairman of electrical engineering, and I kept both jobs.
Mm-hmm. Were you teaching at that time too, or did you?
I think, as I look back on that, I think I taught one class during that period, and I missed that very much. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now I may have taught a couple of. One of the things you might be interested in. One of the things I didn't, that teaching didn't work out very well, and that is the students couldn't get to me. Hmm. I mean the. Demands on the administrative demands for both places were such that, you know, student wants to talk to me, he wants to talk to you now, not
Make an appointment.
Not make an appointment for 2 weeks from Thursday, you know, mm-hmm. and that was, I became very sensitive to that. Because that isn't the way I used to teach, as far as
direct contact with the students.
Yeah, I had contact with the students, and I enjoyed it very much. That's what I wanted to do.
How was it that you became dean of the College of Engineering?
How? Oh, I don't know. Ryder resigned from the job and went back to teaching electrical engineering about 1957 or thereabouts, I'm not sure. And Jake Neville was provost at the, or academic vice president or whatever they called him at the time, and he did the usual thing and appointed a search committee and what have you, and it came out of that.
And what year did you become dean?
I'm trying to think.
Was it late 60s? Or?
Yeah, it had to be late 60s and so on. We had moved the, I don't remember dates very well, and electrical engineering had moved out of the building next door. We were over here too. And gave up the entire building to the computer operation one way or another and moved them over to the engineering building when it was completed.
And that was completed in the 60s. So.
When it was. Now, when I first came here, that were the sheep barns.
Oh, right. Just south of the river, huh?
It wasn't much south of the river. I think the education building had just been completed in there sometime.
And that became Erickson Hall?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How had the curriculum changed in the time at the time that you took over? Was there, had you instituted any of those changes, like shifting away from graduate work? Or
as graduate programs increased fairly drastically, and that they would have had to, there wasn't much to start with, and they started to become quite effective. I would say that you could characterize the undergraduate program as changing in this way, and not only here, but nearly every engineering institution in the country, from hands-on operation to science-based operation. And I think that would describe ours, and as I said, I think it would describe nearly all engineering programs.
In that period, what were the areas that developed well here, where we had ended up with a good reputation, or a reputation?
Well, electrical engineering. Electrical engineering and mechanical engineering were the two largest ones, and were probably the best answer to your question. Mechanical engineering had a lot of influence, of course, in the automobile business in Michigan.
Was there an attempt to reach out to any of those corporations, or obviously
to do what?
To reach out for any of those corporations,
Very much so. We ran seminars that brought in engineering executives from all the major corporations in Michigan during this period of time, which were pretty effective. They did both a good educational job and made us a lot of friends.
How would you say that businesses responded to MSU engineering graduates?
We have always had a very, very good industrial thing. We teamed up with Jack Shingleton for years and really turned out a product and sold it.
And Jack was a placement director?
Yeah. Well, when I first started working with the you have to realize first that you're leading up to the right questions. The proof of the pudding for engineering undergraduates, will people buy them? If they don't buy them, you're dead. I mean, you don't care what rating It's like this, do you look at the Wall Street Journal? Do you see this material on the Tuck School?
No, I didn't see that one.
It's very interesting. Anyway, if the industry doesn't buy them, it doesn't make any difference what the rating services say and so on and so forth. And
we've always... What the grades on the transcript are. What the grades on the transcript are?
Bye. So when we first teamed up selling our students, Jack Breslin was the placement director.
Did you have a good working relationship with him?
Oh, very good.
Yeah.
And then, what was his name? Kinney was the placement director.
Okay.
And then Jack Shingleton. We probably had more action going with Jack Shingleton Shingleton kept running into a lot of trouble from other places on the campus because they claimed that he was giving favoritism to engineering students and so on and so forth. And the answer is he was. And his answer was he's giving favoritism to anybody he can sell.
Yeah.
What? If he hadn't got a product I can sell, I'm in trouble, and so are you.
Yeah. Interesting way to look at it. I hadn't heard that other places on campus were...
Oh, yeah, they used to give him a hard time right
favoritism,
away.
Yeah.
No, the answer to your question, Ari, we always had always did very, very well on selling. We always had our people sold extremely well.
Were there any graduates that from that era that can't come to mind? That not that you remember them all, but certainly there might be some that from that era that were the stars.
I'll tell you something you might not think is funny. What was the murder case in Boulder?
Ramsey.
Ramsey? He's one of our graduates of that era. I'm not selling that. No, our era. If you look now at what happened, where are these people now from that era? They're the vice presidents and what have you of industrial concerns all over the country now. It takes a little while for them to get to that spot. But
when you became dean of engineering, did you leave the computer lab at that time, or did you stay on?
No, I kept it for a little while.
Okay.
But then got rid of it. I don't mean it's got rid of it.
No, your responsibilities expanded. Yeah. Did you teach at all when you were dean?
No. I think one or two classes, and one of the main reasons was the thing I gave you a little bit ago. It just didn't work out well.
How did the Department of Computer Science develop?
We originally created, when we brought the courses out of mathematics back in electrical engineering, just to give them a home for the moment, we created a program in the College of Engineering that was not a department, but we called it a program in computer science, and we started teaching, and we did hire some people for it, and we started teaching a great number of courses in the area. And then that gradually developed into the consideration of full department status for computer science.
Did the MSU pattern fit the national pattern in terms of interest in that field, or were we a little lagging behind, or how would you make it?
Oh, I don't think we were lagging behind. I think we were moving with the tide more than anything else at that particular time. I don't know, that's a big department now.
A lot of students going into that field. What were some other things that happened, let's say during the 1970s, during your early years as dean, that you faced, either administratively or the college?
We started moving over there in the 60s. We started running out of space.
Because you had a large number of students coming in?
We started running out of space. We did something at that point that Hannah even called me up and complained about.
What was that?
We started, due to a lack of space and with the approval of Provost Winder, we started changing the requirements for the entry into the junior year fairly drastically. For some years there, we set quotas as how many students we could take. And for some years, that meant at the end of the sophomore year, you had to have somewhere between a 3.3 and a 3.4 average for entry in the junior year. Mm-hmm. Hannah called me up one day and told me that was terrible. Mm-hmm. He's probably right.
Mm-hmm. What? Because that was increasing.
But that was the only way we can handle it with money and space available. That was the only way we can handle it. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a very popular program. I used to talk to a lot of lawyers. Uh-huh. He used to come around to see me. They were going to sue us for something or other. And I,
for lack of admission or not allowing the person.
Didn't take their client's son into the thing. Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. That's kind of the first I'd heard that the limited facility or limited the program. That's interesting.
I don't know if that has happened anywhere else on the campus or not. Uh-huh. How do you handle it?
Yeah. Well, I think in College of Education, they recently, in the last few years, they've raised the bar quite a bit about that 3.3, 3.4 level, about the same thing.
Recently. Winder wasn't very happy about it, uh-huh. but he let us do it.
Yeah. How about some other presidents, like